Campus FM presents Treasures from Malta. This episode was originally recorded for the Treasures from Malta podcast series, produced by Fondazione Patrimonio Malti. Hello and welcome to season 3 of the Treasures from Malta podcast, a podcast series produced by Fondazione Patrimonio Malti. I am Francesca Balzan, an artist and art historian who goes back a long way with Patrimonio. In this podcast, I meet some of Malta's living treasures. My guest today is a photographer whose art history is much admired, going to great lengths not only to record what might soon disappear, but making seemingly impossible photographs that continuously elicit awe and wonder from his ever-growing fan base. He is a godson with a deep love for his birth island. Through his photography, and it must be said, his incessant curiosity, he has made several discoveries and proposed theories about cultural conundrums. He has also increasingly turned his rightful indignation at the destruction of old buildings into activism, using his great skills in photography and digital art to show up the apologists and would-be destroyers. He has received numerous awards for his photography work, both locally and abroad, and he has exhibited widely. He is also a book designer, sometimes combining both his photography and his design skills in the production of a book. And wait for this, he has photographed and designed more than 136 books. I know publishers who have published far less books than that. Daniel Celia, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. This is a great honor, seeing the very important people you had before me. So I'm very honored to be here.
You're one of them. Daniel, that's crazy to go back to the books. 136 books. Now, of all of them, does any particular book stand out for you and why?
Well, I like saying always the next one, because the next one is the one I'm working on now, which I'm the one in most in love with. The most favorite one of mine is obviously Malta Before History, the one I had edited as well way back in 2004 when it was published, but I had been working on it for about 15 years. That book was obviously particular to me because I edited myself. I was, you know, finding the authors, running after them, something which I enjoyed doing then. I don't think I want to do it again, but because doing the editing and then doing the layout of the book, plus doing the photography, and it's a bit too much. So I prefer letting the editing be done by somebody else nowadays.
Daniel, you're also one of the greatest Gozophiles I know. You were born in Gozo in 1963, and you still keep a home in Gozo, returning and working there on a regular basis. What does Gozo actually mean to you?
Well, you know, I think this is something which happens in every country. I'll just give an example. I still meet people when I used to be a nurse, and I still meet people who I did their plaster 40 years ago, and they would not remember my name, but they would remember Lian Lauchi, Liam Tilomil Gips. You know, I'm the Gozetan who did the plaster for them. We have, sometimes I feel, and I'm proud of it, I must say, I feel that we have like a tattoo on our forehead saying Gozetan. Whatever we do, because, you know, when we get interviewed, when we talk about, when somebody mentions us, I see it in the newspapers, I see it on TV, it's like the Gozetan Daniel Chile. I mean, you know, okay, I'm Maltese too, but I don't mind it in that way. But sometimes, yes, I do think that all Gozetans are Maltese, as all Maltese should be Gozetans. Mm-hmm. We're one country at the end of the day. So, but yes, I love Gozo, obviously. I was brought up there. I was lucky enough to be a Cub Scout and then a Boy Scout. So we used to go for walks. We used to go around. Things were explained to us. You get to know things about Gozo that many people don't know. I used to play on the Cittadella. I used to form part when I was 14, cleaning up the Cittadella.
The Cittadella, of course, is the ancient capital of Gozo, which is partially in ruin,
exactly,
but is also the site of the Cathedral of Gozo, the Matrice.
Exactly. And, I mean, as you said, I became part also of Wirt Audish, other NGOs. I helped, if I could in any way, to, you know, keep Audish as beautiful as gorgeous as it is. In fact, another book I'm planning for this year, for the end of the year, it's called actually The Gozo I Love. Yeah. Things about Gozo that they're not always sort of, you know, like that clear for everybody. Mm-hmm. And like a book I just published last year called Treasures of Gozo, which explains to the children of Gozo. It was distributed to all the children of Gozo for free through the primary schools the private and the government. And like that, they get to value what Gozo is all about. Mm-hmm. Also, Malta, let's face it, it's not like there's a big difference. But Gozo, being so small, offers so much. I mean, I come from a town which has 5 feasts, for example, 2 opera houses. There's something always happening. The enthusiasm that there is in Gozo, coming from an island which is 30,000 people, it's amazing.
The concentration of culture and cultural offerings that come out of Gozo is truly remarkable. But Daniel, you mentioned that you started out in life as a nurse. Now, what actually drew you to photography and how did it start?
Well, it started earlier. I think I was about 13. My cousin is Elvin Scicluna, the mm-hmm. famed Elvin Scicluna of the CBC television, the programs that he's done, and we're first cousins. I remember him once when he's slightly older than me, and he was quite good in drawing, in pencil drawing. And I saw him doing a flower, a leaf, you know, just simply, and I was quite like, wow. I mean, I never saw, my sisters are not artistic, my parents aren't either. I was like, that's something I would like to do. Being who I am then, and I'm still like that, I don't have the patience to sit down and learn. I want to get to do it. I mean, I want the results quickly. That's why I love doing even books, because I don't want a book to be there for 10 years. I want to work on it and get it published. And I tried my hand at it. I wasn't good. And then suddenly I discovered photography, because with photography I could do, in a way, sort of, you know, draw things without learning. So I went with my pocket money buying an Instamatic Kodak camera, which don't exist anymore. Practically, it's a bit similar. It's very close to our mobiles of our days. I mean, it's a point and shoot. You don't do anything. You press the button. As the first Kodak camera was publicized at the time, you press the button, we do the rest. And that's how it was at the time. And then I just got on. And I mean, I just, you know, I started getting results and, you know, then everything, as they say, the rest is history. Then once people start saying that they like what you're doing, you start investing more time into it, learning more about it, reading about it, which is very important, seeing other photographers' works. I remember when I was young in the library, I was influenced quite a lot with Richard England's black and white photography as well. So there was something, you know, I never wanted to do wedding photography, not because wedding photography has anything to criticize. It's just something which I didn't want to be controlled in that kind of system, like Il Prechet, you know, the order, or doing, you know, like the portrait photography, that passport photography, things like that. I wasn't too much into that. I already liked history way back, because my father used to take me with him when he took the students of the primary class to Malta for the visits. For example, I'm so happy to go to see the armory again. I remember it. I remember it so clearly. I must have been there something like 12 times. The Hypogeum. We used to go, you know, once a month, they used to bring us over. My father used to organize with another teacher. He used to come, you know, he used to be with the teacher, not to teach, but to control the students. boys, naughty, running all over the place. My father was quite disciplined, so he used to come over. And I used to hang, because anything to miss a class at the time as a little boy. But we visited these places, and I think that's what something stuck in me way back. Seeing these fantastic places that we have in Malta and in Gozo, you start saying, you know, this is worth getting to know more about. Okay. And then I started combining it. I mean, way back, I have, for example, an archive, which was done a bit later on, but, you know, quite early in my career, of all the Cittadella. There's something like, I don't know, 350 photographs of everything that there was at the time I think this was 1984, 85, everything there was in the Cittadella, everything. I mean, every well, every hole, every graffiti.
Set out to document it.
Exactly. And it's there. And today, when it's been restored, it's become, you know, quite a valuable thing. I gave it then to the National Archives in Gozo. Mm-hmm. And because these are all photographs, some of them are thumbnails like this, but we didn't have computers there. So they would be, you know, where the well is. And then there's a plan of Shepardel and with a yellow line going to, you know, show where it is. Uh-huh. And there are, you know, they're placed on these sort of like A3 boards. Mm-hmm. So people can have a good glance of where everything is.
You really have an archivist's mind in doing so. We'll come to it later because I want to ask you about organizing photographs and how you set about determining what subjects to shoot. Let's just go back to the beginnings of your career in photography. So eventually you dropped your profession as a nurse and you took up photography full time. And in 1988, you moved to Florence. 2 years later, you found yourself in charge of the photographic department of the Art Institute of Florence, which is named Lorenzo de' Medici. And you stayed on for the subsequent 5 years. Now, how did this come about and what did this role entail?
Well, I applied in 1988. I applied for a scholarship. The Italian government was giving art scholarships to multi-students. I applied for photography because I was a photographer. I mean, at the time, I was actually told to apply as a graphic designer, which I did not want to because I was not. I mean, now I have sort of become a graphic designer because I designed the books. But at the time, I wasn't. Being a stubborn, you know, the stubborn Daniel I am, I kept saying, no, if I want to go, I want to go as a photographer. And eventually, I did get it. When I went up, I came across this American teacher who was teaching us, who was very, very artistic, but wasn't very technical in photography. Something which you have to know the techniques in photography. It's not like, unfortunately, many times people just point and shoot. But if you want to have it as a profession and if you want to understand, and also I have a mantra in my work, I always say that I don't take pictures. Actually, I get angry with people who tell me, you know, that you took a photo. I say, no, I take photos when I go on a holiday, maybe. But when I'm working, I make them because I conceive them. I think about them. I know what aperture I'm using. I know what shutter speed I'm using. I've already decided beforehand the composition. You make a photo. There's a big difference between taking a photo and you make a photo. And James White, this American photographer, saw this in me immediately. And he asked me, he used to work as a fashion photographer. And he asked me if I would want to be his assistant. And I said, yes, I took immigration leave from nursing and went up to Florence. Eventually, I did 2 years working in the fashion industry with James. And also in the meantime, whenever there was something technical to explain in his photography classes at Lorenzo de' Medici, obviously I was called to do it myself. James had decided to move back to America. I had to fill in a month class, not the 4 month semester. The school was very happy with what I did and what the results of what the students had said. I mean, I was still quite young. I was 24. I had no degrees or anything. So you never know. I filled in James' space because he wasn't there and they had no other teacher to get at that time. Then eventually when James moved back to America in 1990, they employed me full time. And I must say, I consider myself very lucky because in those 5 years, as you're teaching, as any teacher knows, maybe I have some teacher genes because both my parents were teachers. When you teach, you learn so much. It's the best way of learning is when you teach.
Obviously, you were right in the phase when we started to give up on analog and shifted to digital. Did it affect your art and were you resistant to this change or did you embrace it?
Well, as I said, when I was teaching mostly black and white photography. We had the dark room, which I had set up because then at that time also what happened, Lorenzo de' Medici had moved from one place to another and they gave me the, since I knew what they needed, I practically planned the photographic department, where the enlargers had to go, where the studio had to go, the whole thing. But most of the classes were about black and white photography, you know, the actual analog system of having a film, by, you know, shooting it, developing it in the lab, and then printing it at the school as well. And that kept on going. We're talking, you know, I left then by 1995. Digital photography, or the famous or infamous Photoshop, started to be used quite early. There was something that most people don't know called the quantum paint box.
This was a machine which had specific software in it, which could actually fix, digitize, but not digitized by the camera, but digitized, because when we print books or when whatever you do as an offset printing, you what you do is you get the slides at the time, the transparencies we had, which are passed through a laser which scans them and then makes them into a digital film, which then later on gets printed. Now, in that process, they realized that they can start fixing things. And I remember when I did one of my first books called Legacy in Stone, way back in 1990, we actually started fixing. I had used a camera called a view camera, which is like, you know, those cameras where you see the photographer underneath a cloth. Like the photos we have, you know, of Richard Ellis were done with these few cameras. I used one of these actually to do this book way back in 1990. And unfortunately, when you're putting the film, because you have to put it in manually as well in these boxes, I was, you know, I had a lot of hair at the time. So many times, you know, one of my hairs would fall on the film itself, on the plate. And then that shows up in the image. And in that case, it started to be cleaned. They could actually remove the hair. I mean, this cost a ton of money. I mean, we're talking about at the time, it would have cost today something like 45,000-50,000 euros. Not everybody could afford it. This was in Turin as well. It wasn't in Malta. I mean, we used to take things there. It was to scan them, and they could fix them with this quantil, something like that was called. I forgot now. Time has passed. Machine. And I was there seeing it, I mean, at the time, and I was like wondering and say, oh my God, you know, what we can do in the future. If I only knew what we would have been able to do in the future. Then eventually in 1996, when I left the school because I started doing more books and I couldn't keep on coming and going at the time to keep up with my books, which I was already doing one book a year during the period I was at school. I used to teach on the Tuesdays morning and the evening, and then Thursdays morning and the evenings. On Friday, I used to come to Malta, do the photography Saturday and Sunday, and on Monday I returned back, so I could go back to school. Practically all the money I did then from the books went into airline tickets. We didn't have the cheap sort of, you know, flights of today. I mean, I remember it used to cost about 500 euros going and coming from Italy to Malta at the time. But books were books, and I wanted to, I wasn't really doing it for the money, if I could sort of do them still. And still had the money I had from school, it was good enough for me. But then in 1997, I did a book, The Three Cities. And at one point, the company in Malta, which was doing the digitization at the time, we didn't need to go to Turin anymore, they also had one of the first Photoshops. And they started manipulating my images, which pissed me off badly. For example, I still remember, and it's in the book, you can still see it, because the book, The Three Cities, is still there, when there was this this worker fixing a balcony in Birgu. I took the photo, I made the photo then, and when they came to do the manipulation, when they came to scan it, they actually removed the wires which were passing on top of the balcony, which was okay, because those wires were ugly. Today I remove wires all the time in my books. I hate them. I hate wires. At the time we had antennas on the roofs as well. But what they did then, what the mistake that they did, was they left the shadows in. So you could see the shadows, because the shadows were down, you know, by the balcony, lower down in the wall. And when you open it on a screen, you see the wires on top, and you don't think about that there are shadows. So you see the shadows of the wires without seeing the wires, and this really bugged me. I was really angry about it, even with the publisher at the time. And I said, okay, Daniel, you don't like digital, but you have to learn Photoshop. From now on, you touch your own photos. You can't keep on letting other people sort of, you know, touching your images. You have to do it. And then. But I think I'm very lucky that I was exactly in the middle of my career between analog and digital. Mm-hmm. And like that, I knew many things that could be done in digital that we did in analog. Mm-hmm. They were easy to transfer from one to the other. I mean,
yeah, it's a good foundation to have anyway. And even you tend to be technically minded, so it must have been pretty simple for you to actually learn these skills.
Yes, yes. It was more the computer part which was difficult for me because I wasn't into so much. I mean, I was using the computer and the typewriter to make the class lectures as when I was in school. But it wasn't really, so, you know, touching photos. I was used to the darkroom. I was used to the analog. We used to, you know, put our hands to give more light or remove light from an image. And now the terminology in Photoshop and any programs is practically the same. We say we dodge and we burn in. Mm-hmm. You don't do anything of that in digital with Photoshop, but those are the terminology which are still being used just as much as even in digital publishing. We say the leading. Most people don't even know what leading is. There was a moment also when I was a nurse, I used to go and help in a newspaper to actually put in what was the lead. The words, the typography at the time were on pieces of lead, chomp, uh-huh. And you used with tweezers, put them in line and make the page layout. That's not something I really enjoyed. I used to go at night and work in this printing house and do the layout with lead. And that's what in computers we say leading.
I see. So historic references. But talking about leading and about layout, this brings us to the fact that you're a designer of books. So all this preparation, early preparation when you were young, you're much younger, was actually building up towards your sense of aesthetics and how to lay out a book. And this reminds me that I recently reviewed a book that you had designed, and you had actually taken photographs for it as well. It's the Talis one, the book about the Talis church in Valletta. And the one thing that I found really useful as a reader was that you ensured that the imagery corresponded exactly to the text on the actual same page. That meant that I didn't have to keep flipping between different pages to see what the author was describing in the text. Now, that might seem really obvious, but it is not always the case with books, especially books about art, because they tend to be very image-heavy, and it's very difficult to combine the text and the image on the very same page. Is that a hallmark of your design?
Yes, I think so, because, as I said, when I was interested in history, when I was younger, at that time, most of the books were actually not as you're explaining. You'd have a section in the book which had imagery, and then the rest were text.
Yeah.
And so you're reading something really interesting, but you're not seeing it. You have to flip some 20 pages to get to see it, and then go back to where you were reading, make sure you have a bookmark, find it. But that breaks the beauty of a book. Yes. When you're reading a novel, you imagine things. You don't have to see images. But if the author is telling you, look how beautiful this Caravaggio painting is, your curiosity is going to be to take you to see what the author is talking about, obviously. And yes, that has become something I'm really fixated about. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't realize how that is the most difficult thing of, you know, in doing those kind of books.
Yes, I can imagine.
Because I'm really fixated about it.
Daniel, how did you actually learn to design? And why did you get into that aspect?
Well, in the beginning when I started, obviously somebody else designed my books. Or I would be with somebody else to put the order of the photographs together. Being a very finicky person as I am, sometimes I was never happy with what was given to me. And instead of going into arguments and sort of, you know, telling a designer what to do, when I was at the Lorenzo de' Medici, I did a typography course as well, because being a teacher there, I could also take other classes. Like for me, it was very, very important to take all the history of art classes then. You know, I did 5 years. I went through all of them.
That explains the knowledge then.
well, that was mostly Italy, but more than Malta. I mean, but, you know, it's very important as well as a base, because, I mean, in Malta, many things were happening because of Baroque Italy and during the night and all that. So you make connections then. You come to it. And in the case of typography, obviously seeing a lot of books. I mean, if you come to my house in Malta or my house in Italy, there's walls covered with books. Because, and National Geographic, for example, one thing you say a hallmark in my books is also that most of them don't have just a small caption, but all of them have a small paragraph as a caption. That is what I say, a National Geographic trend. I learned photography looking through National Geographic magazines that my father collected. And most of them don't have a short caption, but a longish caption.
Daniel, we've touched very briefly upon the printing of books. And that's the printing of a book is actually an art in its own right, just to get the colors right and to have them faithful to the images you actually see on your computer screen is usually a real struggle. Now, how involved do you get in that aspect? And are you at the printer seeing the first samples being printed off?
But yes, always. I mean, first of all, you have to understand that, you know, my work is photography besides the typography. But if the photography is not printed well, then I've had it. I still remember also way back in 1996, I did a black and white book, which was something of a dream for me to make a black and white book. It was called Melet at Gaul. And in Turin, this was not, you know, it was in Italy. The printing was done so badly. I spent 2 days crying. Literally crying and thinking of returning back to nursing. This was, I had left school by then, and I was so disappointed with seeing the beautiful color of black and white. We used to call it then the zone system. We had 10 colors, 10 black and white, from solid black to solid white, the paper. And we used to play around with the way we shot the film. I mean, we shot the actual photographs and the way we developed the film and then the way we printed it. Sometimes I printed something for 30 times before I got it right and happy. And then you see it printed, and what we call the colors of black and white were, instead of having 10, you get 4 or 5. Which obviously takes away all the beauty. In fact, I never continued doing black and white. I packed my dark room there and then and never went back to it. I mean, I wouldn't want to touch the issue of black and white nowadays with digital manipulation. Once I said on TV that at the end of the day, you know, black and white is manipulation. We never see a scene in black and white. So it's easier to do. I mean, it's much easier to show something that they can never see with their own eyes. But going back on the printing, yes, I'm there. I'm there. If they tell me be there at 6 o'clock in the morning, I'm there. I mean, I go to the printers. In Italy, sometimes I have to travel miles. When we used to print in Turin, I used to travel from Florence, drive for 5 hours to get to Ivrea, where we did the books. So I would be there, yes. I wanted to make sure, first of all, there are two reasons why you do this. I know the images. I know the photography. So I would choose a number, what we call a signature. Books are divided up in 16 pages, which we call signatures. If they're a smaller book, they're 32. And I would choose the most difficult one of them all and start off printing with that. Once I set the machine, we keep those settings and do the rest of the book. And sometimes, yes, printers see me as a bit of a, you know, not all of them are very happy that I'm there. Because what would usually take an hour to set off could take 2 hours if I'm there and being finicky to get the job well done. But that's what it is. I mean, at the end of the day, unfortunately, nobody says, oh, this book is so well printed. Many times it's like, oh, you're such a, you know, the photography is so good. And the printer doesn't get any really credit. But the other way around is also happens. If the printing of the book is done badly, then the photographer hasn't done the proper job. So, yes, there's another reason. They're my babies. I mean, I love doing books. I don't have real babies. Of course, I cannot compare books with babies. But to me, yes, I get excited. I'm lucky enough, I think, that after doing so many books, I'm excited. I can't sleep the night we're going to start the printing. Sometimes, you know, they tell me to be there at 7 o'clock in the morning. I'm used to wake up because I wake up because of the photography itself. Sometimes sun rises and I have to be there early. But it's not the first time that still today when I'm doing a book, I don't get to sleep at night. I'm so excited that tomorrow I'm going to go to the printers and we're going to start yet again another book. So, yes.
And it's the birth of yet another baby.
The birth of another baby. And then again, there's another important, which I would recommend to everybody. If you are there, present, and you're showing that you're interested and you talk with the printer and you take his advice and he takes your advice and there's this kind of connection between you, you'd be sure that the printer is going to care more about doing your book. Because he says, this person cares. I've done other books and nobody comes here whilst I'm doing the book. This could be for photography. This could be for painting. This could be for anything. Most people, you know, send the book to the printers and that's it. And then they wait for it to be ready. A printer being there and seeing you participant with him working, sometimes, as we said, you start at 6 o'clock in the morning. Sometimes you travel in Italy. I have to travel the distance from here to Sicily to get to some printers. But seeing that you've made that effort, yes, they would do a better job for you as well.
Now, we've talked about Italy and you've mentioned that you travel in Italy and everything, but you've actually got a second home in Italy and that's at San Miniato in Tuscany. Now, tell us about San Miniato and why did you choose to settle there in particular?
Well, as I said earlier, I used to work in Florence teaching and then I used to live in Florence and I lived in Florence for about 22 years. What happened then with the flights, which became cheaper, one of these low-cost flights started working from Pisa. And once before, to come to Malta, I used to always have to travel between Florence, Malpensa, Malpensa, Malta, or Florence, Rome, Rome, Malta. Wait at the airport. The costs were what they were, much higher. I mean, for me, it was a dream come true to have a flight from Pisa, which is in Tuscany. And also with, you know, obviously being low cost, I started using, I used to come, whilst before I used to come, for example, maybe once a month and then spend 2 weeks here to work and then return back to Florence. Now I started coming, like I say, I joke about it, but
like catching the bus.
No, actually like the ferry boat of Gozo, coming and going all the time.
True.
And sometimes cheaper.
So why San Miniato, though?
First of all, I was lucky enough. I had the time to go around and see the places in Tuscany with my partner. And we saw this, we saw there. We wanted to find somewhere not too far away from Florence, where I had my friends, my work, colleagues, and other things. And where I had made a living for such a long time. And I'm still very much in love with Florence as well. I mean, it's like going back, I get excited too. I mean, when I get back to Florence. And at the same time, we wanted to be close to the airport of Pisa because of this traveling all the time. Before, when I lived in Florence, it used to take me about an hour to get from Pisa to Florence and then another hour to find parking in Florence because Florence, being such a small city, it has its own problems with cars as well, like here. Yeah.
So practical reasons, really. And San Miniato was bang on in the center of the
Exactly. It's exactly between Pisa and Florence. It's well connected by train as well. So if I don't want to take the car, it's connected by train. There's a train going from Pisa and Florence all the time. And so it's easy to get to the airport from there. It's easy also because I invite a lot of people to come to San Miniato in my guest room over there. So I have to pick them up. I just get the car and go and pick them up. It just takes about half an hour to get from San Miniato to Pisa. It's a beautiful town. It's a really beautiful place. It's got some of these
connections.
The Emperor Frederick II actually, had a relation with Malta. But he also was the one who founded the city. In fact, it's called, since there is San Miniato in Florence and many places, there's something like 22 San Miniato, all in Tuscany, small places. Most in Florence, there is San Miniato al Monte. And then one in where I live, it's called San Miniato al Tedesco, because obviously Federico was German. So it's known as San Miniato al Tedesco. It's on top of a hill. It's a beautiful little town. The population is more or less that of Gozo. And I go there mostly. I don't do photography that much over there. My work is in Malta. My photography is mostly concerned in Malta. But I say that I go there. It's a bit like I go to my Lavoro di Certosino. It's where I go in my monastery. I go and work on the design of my books, the editing of my photography. Nobody bothers me. Nobody calls me for any appointments like I have all the time in Malta. Nobody calls me to do any photography. And I go there. And sometimes I work for 18 hours a day. on the design of the books. We live in the middle of the countryside. I go out for a run. It's a beautiful place to stay in.
Having said that, you have regaled us with some lovely photographs of San Miniato and the lovely dawns and some beautiful fog-covered scenes of the landscape.
Yes, because I live right... San Miniato is a bit like Zabuch and Gozo, to try to explain it. It's on top of a ridge, of a hill. It's one road, really. I mean, it's two roads running on top of this hill. And I live on one of these roads. So actually, I have a direct view from where I live on the back side of the valley, which goes to Pisa. Actually, I see the Carrara Mountains from my bedroom. We're talking about 60 kilometers far away.
Of course.
And on the other side, we see there's some beautiful scenes of Tuscany.
And are you known as Il Maltese over there?
Yes, actually, yes. Il Maltese qua, Il Maltese là. The mayor knows about me. He's visited. Actually, there was a funny thing. When the vice mayor once visited me, I was working on a book. I hadn't... So, you know, really washed or shaved for about 3 days. I was really engrossed into it. And I see this beautiful woman knocking on my door. And it's like, what the heck? What's happening? Sort of, you know, I wasn't expecting her. She said, oh, Dave, we've been hearing about you. And
check you out.
Yeah, no, she wanted to say sort of, you know, hello. And I was working on, I had just finished doing Gorgeous Gozo back then. And what happened was, when I started showing her this book, she said, but how large is this island? That's for Gozo. And I told her, it's like 7 kilometers by 5. She said, that's smaller than here. The population is as much as ours, but you've got so many things happening over there. Sort of, I have to visit. I have to come and see it because this place is amazing. I mean, you have so many churches, so many feasts, so many, you know, they have a band. They have one band in San Miniato. Has about 22 people. In Gozo, there's 4 or 5 different bands of you know, of 50 people.
So, Daniel, you're flying the flag for us. You must behave while you're there.
Great.
Now, let's take a break, and then we'll come back to find out more. This episode, originally recorded for the Treasures from Malta podcast series and now being broadcast on Campus FM, is a conversation between me, Francesca Balzan, and my guest, photographer Daniel Celia. And we're back. Don't forget to go to our podcast page on www.patrimonio.org to see pictures and links to what we've discussed in each podcast episode. Daniel, your photography has led you to a number of discoveries. In 2019, you gave a delightful talk at Palazzo Falson called Curiosities of Endina, and there you showed us little details in Endina that were hidden in plain sight, and that you managed to link to historic events. And often you were proposing connection which was new, completely new. That talk was so popular it had to be repeated more than once. Now give us an example of one of these discoveries.
Yes, I mean, that is going to be eventually becoming a book. It was supposed to come out before the pandemic. It was going to be launched actually at Palazzo Falzon. We had already all plans and all that, but then everything, you know, got postponed. Well, yes, luckily enough, I worked with a lot of people and a lot of authors, and you get a lot of different anecdotes. Don Juan at Sock Party was fantastic. He could tell you things about a doorway, for example, that I didn't mention this when we spoke, for example, in the talk. I'm going to mention it now, and it's going to be in the book, obviously, where there's a doorway, which is behind the Benedictine monastery, which if you pass today, it's next to Shara Pérez Hotel, just to explain, you see that it's walled up, it's closed in. Because the nuns didn't want the young couples who used to go into this doorway and stay kissing there. So they barred it off. And this is Endina, like many other places in Monte Gozo, is full of these things. A discovery I had made was that in one of the old rooms of the cathedral, there were actually beams... Mm-hmm. which Gianfrancesco Bella describes as being the beams of the old cathedral, of the old medieval cathedral. And these were placed there when the cathedral was still intact. So, you know, there's the coat of arms of Malta. Why? Because I happen to be up there. I'm always curious. I want to put my nose where maybe sometimes I'm even not supposed to go in. And when I went in there, I see these beautiful beams and say, what are they doing here? Nobody sees. Nobody comes up here. This is on top of a roof in that... you can see it from everywhere in Malta, practically. There's this chapter hall, which has the sloping roof. In the sloping roof, there are these actual beams, and then many other things. I mean, the holes where the Benedictine sisters look down into the street, nobody actually realized that behind those holes are the nuns, and then the people of Imdina know when the nuns are there. How do they know? Because the pigeons don't lay down into the holes if the nuns are watching down in the street. So, yeah, I think it's going to be a fun book. And there's a lot of things to discover in Imdina, being the oldest city we have.
Something to look forward to. Daniel, we mentioned that you've taken a lot of images throughout your life, of course, and you mentioned, for example, that you took a lot of photographs of the Cittadella. And I must say that whenever we need an image and that no one seems to have taken, we always say, let's ask Daniel. You've built this incredible archive of images. Now, how do you go about organizing them?
In Italy, I've got all my slides, all my transparencies. They're in files, trying to put them into subject matter. Sometimes they're subject matter according to the book I was working on at the time. And I've got a good scanner over there, which if I need any of those images, I can scan them. Easier now with digital, obviously. I mean, digital files. I started with digital in 2003. Mm-hmm. 2004, programs started coming out where the digital, even every mobile shot that we do, has what we call metadata. Mm-hmm. Practically, the metadata is the information of when you took the picture, at what time you took it. Some of them have even the GPS of where you took them, so you can find them by location, what aperture you used, the whole information that you have about the film, about the image. And that makes it much easier to put them into an archival system. Since then, digitally, my archival system has more than 500,000 of photographs. And I actually put other metadata into them. They are all in there by date. So, you know, 2004, 2005, 2006, then by month and by day. And then inside, if I'm doing something about, for example, if you open and see most probably one of the most metadata I've given to images is Gozo. So there's Gozo. Then you've got archaeology. Then you've got prehistory. Then you've got Imdina. Then and then they come together because if you have something which is prehistoric and is also with Imdina, those two things will find you that particular image. And as the archives keep on going, these add up all the time. I am planning, obviously, to leave this archive to the National Archives. I've already talked to to Mr. Farrugia about them. We have to see how it's going to be done.
That's wonderfully generous of you.
Because obviously, being lucky enough to work with heritage mostly and culture, but there's also pictures of feasts, pictures of people. And they have this metadata into them, not all of them, obviously, because sometimes you're in a hurry, but it's there. And in the future, this could be quite useful to see how Malta was 100 years, from now.
It's an ethnographic record, ultimately. So that's wonderful. So these will be accessible in future.
Hopefully, yes.
Yeah, that is really generous of you. Do you have an interest in old photographs? Do you collect or digitize them?
Yes. Well, I'm interested in seeing how before and after. What is funny, actually, there's that fantastic Facebook page with Retro Malt and Retro Gozo. Mm-hmm. Actually, some pictures of mine are appearing in that nowadays. Okay.
They're already retro.
Which tells me, how old I'm getting. you see a postcard that I did way back in 1980 or even before. And it's in Retro Gozo or in Retro Malta. Yes.
Well, before most people we know were born.
My father also was, he wasn't a photographer, but he liked taking pictures. So yes, I have some of his negatives, which I've put in these Facebook pages. I like old photographs. Especially, Richard Ellis' work, for example, I mention him because he wasn't just an archival photographer like many of the time, but he, I don't want to say I'm as good as him I compare our way of working. I mean, he would go and shoot a building in a specific time of day, but sometimes even in a specific time of year, not just like that. Sometimes you plan.
So he put in research into it.
Yes.
It was very.
You could see from his work that he put research into it. It wasn't just, you can't always be coincident. Some people say, oh, you were so lucky to get there. Sometimes they don't know that I was planning it 8 months before. If you see my calendar on my mobile, I've got reminders to go there on that particular day, because with software nowadays, with the apps that we have, I already know where the moon will be sort of setting on that particular day in that particular. So I plan to be there. I was there, for example, I tried to make a shot of the moon setting exactly with the cliffs of Gozo, not this last full moon, but the one before. I was there at 5 o'clock in the morning, and then the clouds came up and I didn't shoot anything. So it was there for nothing. Yeah. I've got to wait another 9 years to get the same shot exactly with the moon.
And you planned that as well? You put that down in your calendar for 9 years' time?
Well, 9 years, no, actually I haven't. We'll see what happens.
You can suggest for yourself in 9 years' time.
Maybe I can send a drone from home and shoot it, you know, remotely in 9 years' time. So many things. I mean, we mentioned the drones. I mean, if anybody would have told me a few years ago that I would have a flying camera, a literally flying camera, I would have said science fiction, but we have it.
Do you use drones?
Yes, I love it. I mean, you know, obviously it's become more complicated nowadays with permissions and all that.
Yes.
But when I started, thank God, there weren't, you know, all these complications. So I have a very good archive of many, many, you know, images from the air, thanks to the flying camera.
Maybe you should whisper that, because I don't know if the law applies retrospectively.
No, it didn't. Actually, no, I know that it did not. I mean, I'm very careful with photographic laws, because I have to defend my own rights.
Absolutely.
But also, I don't want to impose on anybody. I mean, but then you get sometimes people don't understand. For example, if you're in public and you shoot somebody publicly, as long as you don't take them out of their context, I mean, I cannot take a picture of you drinking a soft drink and then make a publicity of that soft drink without telling you.
Yes, for example. The release.
But if you happen to be sitting in Piazza Regina and take a photo of the facade of the library and you happen to be sitting there, sorry, hard luck for you. I mean, the law doesn't cover you in that case. I mean, it covers you if you are in your private property. As long as you don't use it commercially.
Yes, I mean, yes. Now, speaking about the law, you're incredibly generous with lending images to people who ask nicely and credit you. But quite rightly, you come down on people like a ton of bricks. If they steal your photographs, or they reshare and repost, or even use them for their own purposes without permission or credit. Now, tell me about this.
Well, it's my job, first of all. Secondly, I'm proud of my work, so I would hate it to see photos of mine being published or being presented anywhere without my name next to them. And the same thing happens with social media nowadays. People think that anything you can find online is yours. No, it's not like that. It's very clear. I mean, there are specifications. And again, you can't get away with it. Every photograph I do today has what we call, what I put into them because I chose to do it, what's called a digital watermark. So I can prove through software that that is my image. And there's also the metadata.
It's invisible to the eye, of course, but
you can actually... to the eye, but it can be scanned. And many people tell me, why don't you put your watermarks, like many other photographers do? They splash them, because they ruin the photograph. I even hate my name in the corner online, because your eye goes there. Yes. When I do an exhibition, it's a different story. I sign my prints, obviously, but that's a large print. The signature is very tiny in the bottom, so it's not obstructive to the image. But no, I would not allow anybody to take my pictures. It can be the government, it can be a private individual. I will fight, for my rights, for our rights as photographers, because unfortunately, people think that photography is not an art form, or is not something which has copyrighted, because we are copying things. It's not the case. Facebook gives you the right to hold on your work always. And if somebody copies and pastes into Facebook, like it happened with my pictures of Etna when it was erupting last week, I wrote to the person first, because, you know, sometimes people do it without thinking that they're doing something wrong. This person completely ignored me. So there's a way to fill up a form on Facebook, copyright infringement. In less than 2 hours, they removed his photograph. I mean, this copy and paste. I mean, I proved that it was mine, and they just removed it. And sometimes I had groups. I mean, there was a group in Gozo which kept posting always my images without my name on their banner. They did it once. They did it twice. They did it three times. Facebook closed their account.
Daniel, you obviously take great delight in making good photographs, and it seems to me you keep challenging yourself. For example, very regularly you upload on your social media freshly taken photographs of an early morning shoot or late at night, somewhere where I assume it would have entailed a lot of discomfort to get just that right shot. Sometimes it's a photograph of nature, of a sunrise, or a view of Mount Etna. But you've also recently used equipment to bring Etna closer than the naked eye can ever perceive. And I remember a whole debate raging on when someone accused you of photoshopping those photos. Now tell me what equipment you used and what magic you are working to make those impossible photographs.
Well, there's no magic. It's just technique. I have to correct you because you said something you can never see with your own eyes. If you have a proper telescope or binoculars, you see exactly what my camera sees. It's exactly the same procedure. It's the same thing. I mean, you have a really strong binoculars. You point it towards where you know Etna is. It's 9 degrees off north. I know it by heart now. And practically it's there. When it's a nice clear day, like it was yesterday morning, you wake up early. I mean, we have the apps, we have the metro, we have, I see the horizontal visibility. And you go out to see if Etna shows up. It doesn't always show up, even if all the conditions are correct. Between Malta, I mean, Malta and Etna is about 200 kilometers away. Now, the coastline, between Malta and the coastline of Sicily, Pozzallo and that area, is actually closer than the coastline of Sicily is to Etna. So if you get clouds, you can have all the perfect conditions in the Malta-Sicily channel. But then if you have clouds on Sicily itself, then you don't see it. Then you don't see it, no? I mean, I calculate it more or less. For every 15 times I go out to photograph Etna, I get it once. And the results, you see the results of when I get them, not when I don't get them. Then there are lucky moments. I also have my sister in Gozo who wakes up in the morning. She lives in Shara and has Etna right. I have told her where to look. She sees it with her eyes. She doesn't need any binocular or anything. And she calls me up and says, it's showing. Get out of bed and get going. Sometimes she calls me and says, no, I'm already here waiting for it, like yesterday morning. Because she called me up and said, it's really, really showing today. I said, yes, I know, I'm seeing it. I'm at Meliha. And, but it's what you mentioned before is not magic. It's planning. Now I've covered most of them. I used to be a scout. I learned how to do maps and how to do alignments. So many times, even during the summer when I know it doesn't show up, I go to places, I make the alignment and say, oh, look, if I come here, I get the Castle of Salmoun in front. Because my interest of Etna is not really getting a shot of Etna with the sea underneath it. I always try to get something in front of it. So you get a scene of Malta on Gozo, and behind it, you see Etna. So you are...
The remarkable thing is the kind of the extreme foreshortening when, yes, for example, a dome of a church in Malta is juxtaposed exactly on top of Etna as though they're at a distance of a few meters from each other. And that is the magic that I'm referring to.
Yes, that is what I love. I mean, I love doing that. I mean, but many of them are planned. And sometimes, like yesterday, I did a photograph with my partner in front of Etna as if she's holding it up. I think we must have gone there something like 8, 9, 10 times. First to plan it, to see the angle. But when I shot her, she was nearly half a kilometer away from me. This is the foreshortening you are saying. In that case, for example, although she was so far away from me, I still couldn't get what we call infinity focusing. With every camera, with every lens, you have a moment when you get to infinity, and then anything with that infinity, you said the dome, for example, of the church, to Etna, 200 kilometers away, everything is in focus. Yesterday, I couldn't get Etna and Luis both in focus. Mm-hmm. I mean, I had to decide which. When I got Etna in focus, Luis would be out of focus, and vice versa.
You make it sound so simple. Daniel, you're a passionate supporter of our culture and heritage, and you're also incredibly knowledgeable about history and archaeology. Now, you frequently use your skills as a photographer to show the extent of the impact of a proposed new building on the environment, especially when such a building is sited very close to a historic or archaeological site. Now, normally the applicant for a permit tries to minimize and sometimes outright lies about the extent of the visual impact. But you're quick to jump in and to mock up in a far more accurate scale what the building will actually look like once it's built. Now, when did your activism start and what triggered it off?
It started, as I mentioned earlier, when we were cleaning the Cittadella. I mean, I was 14, 13, you know, between scouts and between other, we were Taudish NGO at the time. We were actually called Itfal Talbelt Victoria. We always had this thing to defend anything which was Gozeten historically and even geologically. I mean, anything which is Gozeten. Unfortunately, nowadays, it's all about money. It's all about money. It's not about building, really, because people attack me or tell me that it's not the first time I've met a developer in from Gozeten, and they said, oh, you know what you did? You made us lose that much money because we couldn't build or something like that. I'm not against development, but it's how it's done. I like to give a very simple example. Tapi Inu Church. Does anybody ever say that Tapi Inu Church is uglifying Gozo? Tapi Inu Church is built in the middle of beautiful ODZ Valley. But the way it was built and the way it was amalgamated with the rest of the beauty of the hills of Gozo, to me, Tapi Inu Church has given something, has made Gozo more beautiful.
And it's enhanced the landscape.
Exactly. I mean, now, when these developers who have the money, why can't they invest in beautiful architecture?
You've participated in a number of exhibitions, starting with your first major exhibition at the Museum of Fine Arts in Valletta in 1986, way back. If you were to dream of an ideal exhibition you would like to work towards, what would the theme be and where would you hold it?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I've been lucky enough to exhibit in America, in Italy. I wanted to exhibit in the Palazzo dell'Esposizione di Roma, and I did. I wanted to make an exhibition in the Museum of Archaeology, which was maybe the most ambitious one of them all, which were the faces of all the statuettes of prehistory, and I enlarged them to be as a face of a human face. And then we had the actual statues within the actual exhibition. That was a dream come true to do. We got it in a book as well with Dr. Isabella Vella Gregory. And I would dream about books. I'll tell you why. Not because I don't love doing exhibitions, but I still dream about books because exhibitions take a lot of time to do, to put together. And then they have to be put away.
Yeah. But so what is your dream book? Tell me what your dream book would be.
When I put all that archive into an encyclopedia, a pictorial encyclopedia of the history of Malta.
Wow, so I think you should do it.
I will do it. I mean, if God lets me, you know, gives me the time and the energy, which I think, you know, the energy, I think it's always been there, thank God. Obviously the time, you know, I want to do that at the end. When my archives keep on growing and growing and growing, I sit down and I might even not need to go and do another photograph because I have it there.
Yeah.
And put it all together in a number of volumes to make an encyclopedia, a pictorial encyclopedia of about Malta. Not really the history, but about Malta, all of it.
That would be a monumental work. Daniel, I'm going to wind up here. Thank you so much for taking the time to record this podcast. Thank you for all the beauty you have given us through your photographs and for protecting our heritage with your wonderful art.
Thank you. Thank you for having me in a list of very prestigious persons. You've made me feel proud of myself and looking forward also, because we've worked quite a lot with Patrimonio, to do more work together in the future for the Patrimonio of Malta and Gozo.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Treasures from Malta on Campus FM. This was originally recorded as a podcast, and there are pictures and links to all we've discussed on the Fondazione Patrimonio Malti website,